Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
The climate convention returns to the country where it was born. Today, the eyes of the world turn to Belém with immense expectation. For the first time in history, a climate COP will take place in the heart of the Amazon. In the global imagination, there is no greater symbol of the environmental cause than the Amazon rainforest.
The UN Climate Summit opens in Belém, Brazil, as the Caribbean still recovering from Hurricane Melissa and as the Philippines is hit by back-to-back typhoons. We'll speak with Yeb Sanyo, the Philippines' former climate negotiator, now a leading climate activist. He's in Belém. And The Guardian's Nina Lacani, who's uncovered how thousands of fossil fuel lobbyists got access to UN climate talks over the years and then kept drilling. Finally, Jelani Cobb, the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism. His new collection of essays is titled Three or More is a Riot, Notes on How We Got Here.
I think the real thread that unites the book is democracy and its challenges. And, you know, the subtitle, you know, of the book is Notes on How We Got Here. And that's like the perennial question. You know, how did we get here? Or how did this happen? Or how did we arrive at a moment where we're having to consider this thing or that thing?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has issued sweeping and unconditional pardons to his top allies who aided him in his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. That's according to the Justice Department's pardon attorney. Among those pardoned are Rudy Giuliani, who tried to pressure state legislatures to reject Joe Biden's victory in key swing states; Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff in 2020; John Eastman and Kenneth Cheesebrough, two attorneys who conspired to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the election results on January 6th; Boris Epstein, an advisor to Trump; and Sidney Powell, who filed lawsuits challenging election results in key swing states. The pardons only apply to federal charges. They don't include state charges. Both Powell and Cheesebrough had pleaded guilty to state charges. Giuliani's been indicted in Georgia and Arizona. On Sunday, Trump also pardoned dozens of other Republicans who were involved in the plan to organize fake electors and promote conspiracies of alleged voter fraud during the 2020 election. Earlier this year, Trump had pardoned more than 1,000 January 6th rioters. The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 41st day. On Sunday night, seven Democratic senators broke away from their party to vote alongside Republicans on a key bill to end the shutdown and fund most government agencies until January 30th. The Democratic senators include Tim Kaine of Virginia, Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen of Nevada, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire, and Dick Durbin of Illinois, as well as Maine's independent Senator Angus King. The measure does not include an extension of the expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits. The bill still needs to pass the House before the government can be reopened, and that would require Speaker Mike Johnson to call a House session and finally swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva of Arizona. She would be the final vote on a discharge petition to release the Epstein files. It comes as the Supreme Court Friday granted the Trump administration's request to temporarily block full payment of food benefits through SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The decision means SNAP recipients will receive only partial benefits. The U.S. Department of Agriculture ordered states that were filling in the gap to stop providing full benefits to SNAP recipients, stating they should immediately undo the distributions. Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned air travel would be, quote, reduced to a trickle if the shutdown continues. U.S. airlines canceled more than 3,500 flights over the weekend, impacting tens of thousands of travelers nationwide. Travelers expressed outrage over the delays.
I'm shocked, and it is definitely a Republican shutdown. It's not the Democrats. I understand why they don't want to take all those people off. You know, health and wellness and insurance, it's ridiculous.
Israeli air raids and drone attacks continue in Gaza despite the U.S. brokered ceasefire that went into effect a month ago. Al Jazeera reports two people, including a child, were killed in southern Gaza today. This is Nidal Abu Arkoub from Khan Yunis.
The future is bleak and uncertain. Given our current situation, things remain as they are. Truce, no truce, we do not see a truce. The war is ongoing and the horizon is dark. We see the country's situation as very difficult.
Meanwhile, Hamas handed over the body of Hadar Golden, an Israeli soldier who was killed in the 2014 war in Gaza. It comes as Reuters reports U.S. officials gathered intelligence that Israeli military lawyers warned there was evidence that war crimes charges could be brought against Israel for its war on Gaza. The former U.S. officials who spoke to Reuters said the material was not broadly circulated within the U.S. government until late in the Biden administration. Lawyers with the State Department also reportedly flagged to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Israel might be committing war crimes. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed a Palestinian man in the Farah refugee camp. It comes as Israeli settlers attacked a group of Palestinian villagers, activists, and journalists on Saturday who gathered during an attempt to harvest olives near a settler outpost. Two Reuters journalists, including the photographer Renin Sawafda, were injured in the attack in an area close to the Palestinian village of Beita. This is Mohammed Al-Atrash, a journalist with Al Jazeera, who recounted the attack by the Israeli settlers.
I found myself alone and all the farmers walked down, so I decided to leave the area, and during that they hurled stones towards us like nothing I've witnessed before.
In Oregon, a federal judge has permanently blocked the Trump administration from deploying National Guard troops to Portland. In her ruling, U.S. District Court Judge Karen Immergut, a Trump appointee, said the president, quote, did not have a lawful basis to federalize the National Guard, and that, quote, there was neither a rebellion or danger of a rebellion in Portland, as claimed by the federal government. The ruling is the latest legal blow to the Trump administration as it attempts to crack down on protests against immigration raids nationwide. In related news, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is calling on the United Nations to investigate the U.S. federal government over its, quote, abusive immigration crackdowns, unquote, in the city. Johnson addressed members of the U.N. Human Rights Council Friday.
I call on this council to hold the federal government of the United States to the same standards of accountability you apply elsewhere in the world. No country should be above international law. Human rights are universal, or they are meaningless. Chicago has long been a part of this struggle. I invite the UN's independent experts to visit Chicago to witness both our challenges and our progress firsthand. And I urge the Human Rights Council to consider additional measures of accountability, including a special session to examine the worsening human rights crisis in the United States.
In Massachusetts, a video obtained by the Boston Globe shows a man having what appears to be a seizure after federal immigration agents pushed, hit, and pressed on his neck when the man attempted to hold on to his wife and crying child after the agents ambushed their car. Carlos Zapata, who's from Ecuador, reportedly lost consciousness as a bystander is heard saying on the video, they're trying to rip the baby out of his hands, unquote. His wife was taken into custody by federal agents in front of their daughter, who's 1.5 years old. The Homeland Security Department later mocked the video of Zapata and his family, saying he faked a seizure to try to stop his wife's arrest. She now faces deportation. Two top executives at the BBC Sunday abruptly resigned following the backlash over the public broadcaster's edit of a speech made by President Trump January 6, 2021, before a mob of his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. The resignation of BBC Director General Tim Davey and News CEO Deborah Ternus came just days after the Daily Telegraph published details of a leaked internal memo that said a BBC documentary edited Trump's remarks in a way that it appeared he explicitly encouraged the Capitol insurrection. The BBC is reportedly planning to formally apologize to Trump, who celebrated the resignation, saying on Truth Social, quote, "These are very dishonest people who tried to step on the scales of a presidential election. What a terrible thing for democracy," Trump wrote. Trump's repeatedly defended unfounded claims that his 2020 loss to Joe Biden was rigged. President Trump says the United States is boycotting the G20 summit hosted by South Africa over what he claims is the persecution of white farmers. Trump's repeatedly accused the government of the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, of failing to protect Afrikaners, the white minority that ruled the country during apartheid, and has falsely stated a white genocide is taking place in South Africa. Trump said on Truth Social the U.S. would be hosting the 2026 G20 summit in Miami. This year's G20 summit is the first time a G20 summit was held in Africa. And the UN Climate Summit opens today in Belém, Brazil, where the United States will be notably absent after the Trump administration declined to send a high-level delegation. The U.S. is still expected to influence the climate talks as Trump officials use lobbyists and economic threats to attempt to sabotage environmental initiatives and efforts to cut emissions proposed by representatives from around the world. The United States is one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters, while Trump has called the climate crisis a con job. Meanwhile, representatives from the Alliance of Small Island States are again urging leaders of the global north to commit to stronger action in order to prevent the worst impacts of global warming, including the phase-out of fossil fuels. This is Tuvalu's environment minister speaking in Belém Friday.
We had high hopes that this new agreement would give us the necessary legal measures to protect Tuvalu from the worst impacts of climate change related sea level rise. 10 years on from Paris, we have greatly and gravely concerned about the slow progress in delivering significant emissions reductions to ensure our survival.
Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from COP30 in Belém, Brazil, all next week. And after headlines, we go to Belém to speak with a leading climate justice activist, Yeb Sanyo. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the opening of the UN Climate Summit in Brazil. Stay with us. is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The 30th UN Climate Summit is beginning today in the Brazilian rainforest city of Belém, in the mouth of the Amazon River. Last week, many world leaders gathered in advance for a two-day summit. This is Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
A Convenção do Clima regressa.
The climate convention returns to the country where it was born. Today, the eyes of the world turn to Belém with immense expectation. For the first time in history, a climate COP will take place in the heart of the Amazon. In the global imagination, there is no greater symbol of the environmental cause than the Amazon rainforest.
Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley said the world needs to do far more to help countries most impacted by the climate crisis, including those hit by Hurricane Melissa.
Because all of us should hold our heads down in shame, because having established this fund a few years ago in Sharm el-Sheikh, its capital base is still under $800 million, while Jamaica reels from damage in excess of $7 billion U.S., not to mention Cuba, Haiti, or the Bahamas.
Tuvalu's Home Affairs and Environment Minister Maina Vakufua-Talia criticized the Trump administration for not sending a high-level delegation to the climate summit.
Tragically, the world's largest historical emitter of greenhouse gas emission has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement. I was at the UN General Assembly when President Trump spent a considerable amount of his address to world leaders disparaging renewable energy sources and challenging the scientific consensus on climate change. Mr. President, this is a shameful disregard for the rest of the world. We only need to reflect on the recent impact of Hurricane Melissa that wreaked havoc on Jamaica and Cuba, and Typhoon Tino that hit the Philippines, to understand that climate change is here.
The Trump administration's defended its decision to skip the climate summit. A White House spokesperson said, quote, President Trump will not jeopardize our country's economic and national security to pursue vague climate goals that are killing other countries, unquote. In one of his first acts in office, Trump began the process of withdrawing the U.S. from the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. We begin today's show in Belém with Yeb Sanyo, the former chief climate negotiator for the Philippines. Over the weekend, a major typhoon hit the Philippines, killing at least 8 people and displacing more than 1.4 million others. Typhoon Fanghuang hit as the Philippines was still recovering from another typhoon, which killed at least 224 people just last week. The Philippines has been hit by 21 major storms this year. For Yeb Sanyo, this marks at least the third time he's seen the Philippines hit by a deadly storm during the UN climate summit. This is Sanyo speaking in 2012. After a typhoon hit the Philippines, the storm killed almost 2,000 people.
I appeal to ministers. The outcome of our work is not about what our political masters want. It is about what is demanded of us by 7 billion people. I appeal to all, please, no more delays, no more excuses. Please let Doha be remembered as the place where we found the political will to turn things around. And let 2012 be remembered as the year the world found the courage to do so. To find the courage to take responsibility for the future we want. I ask of all of us here, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? If not here, then where? Thank you, Madam Chair.
In 2013, another typhoon hit the Philippines as Yeb Sanyo attended at the UN Climate Summit in Warsaw.
What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here,
in Warsaw.
At that summit, Yeb Sanyo engaged in a hunger strike, again a Filipino negotiator. Yeb Sanyo joins us now from Belen, Brazil. He's now the chair of the Laudato Si movement, which was formerly known as the Global Catholic Climate Movement. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Yeb. If you can talk about what has happened so far and why you're there, why you're in the gateway of the Amazon at this 30th summit, what the significance of this summit is, and the significance of one of the leading one of the leading carbon gas emitters, the United States, not attending.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be on the show again. But always under difficult circumstances, as you have described. It is, of course, sobering to be here with the backdrop of another catastrophic event back home, a back-to-back typhoons striking the Philippines, which, as you have just mentioned, has happened a couple of times before, and one is just too many. Now, it is important for us to be here as a part of civil society. I think we cannot afford not to engage in a process which endeavors to find lasting solutions to avert a deepening crisis, a crisis that is being felt by many people and communities around the world, a crisis that is real, that is profoundly unfair and that disproportionately impacts the most vulnerable and who had the least contribution in creating this problem. And what is starkly unfair, of course, is not just the absence of the biggest historical emitter in the room, but also the disregard, as we have heard from the minister of Tuvalu, the shameful disregard of the lives of people around the world, and I would say the unethical dismissal of the voices of people around the world who are clamoring for world leaders to actually do something about this crisis. And that we find ourselves in the country where the climate convention was born 30 years ago, at the gateway of the Amazon. I agree that this is not just a symbolic part of the context of why COP30 is being held here. But I think the strength of the voices from indigenous communities, from local communities that are impacted by the climate crisis, as well as for me the context of the strength of faith communities. I consider this, Amy, being now chair of the Laudato Si movement, as a critical juncture in our work to bring in all of the faith communities. Considering that countries are dismally putting forward their nationally determined contributions that should spell out the ambition that is needed to confront the climate crisis. So this is a very important gathering, of course, like before, but for us this is a reckoning. It is a moral reckoning, COP30 it is.
What has changed since that 2013 speech we played a clip of when you were chief climate negotiator for the Philippines at the Warsaw summit? You went on a hunger strike then. This was 12 years ago.
Well, a lot has changed, more particularly the impacts that are being felt in many places around the world, especially people who are already struggling to make ends meet. A lot of radical things have changed in terms of their circumstances, in terms of our circumstances, where typhoons have become more intense, and the scientific basis for saying that typhoons is driven by a warmer world has become a lot more clearer now. And there's of course a lot of things that have changed in terms of the global political leadership, if you can put it that way, if you can consider that as part of the worrying change in how many political leaders have abandoned their duty to have a higher ambition on climate. Now, when we ask what else has changed around the regime on climate change, I can say that there are, of course, little steps that have been taken in the UNFCCC, in the Climate Convention. But if you ask me honestly, I think these are little steps and steps that are too little and probably too late, as we can see that the Paris Agreement implementation has become very difficult and has hit a lot of roadblocks along the way. The can is being kicked down the road every year. There's so much watering down of commitments, and you know, there's just a lot of room to be improved in terms of how countries are working together to effect what President Lula has said is the imperative to strengthen multilateralism.
Watering down is an interesting term to use in this case. In addition to Yeb Sanyo speaking to us from the 30th UN Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil, we're joined here in New York by the UN climate, by Nina Lacani, a senior climate justice reporter for The Guardian US. Her latest piece out today, Climate Disasters Displaced 250 Million People in the Past 10 Years, UN Reports finds. She's also been reporting on the role of fossil fuel lobbyists at the climate summit. Nina Lacani, thanks so much for being back with us. We have spoken to you at climate summits in the past, but you have this explosive piece, how thousands of fossil fuel lobbyists got access to UN climate talks, then kept drilling. You say more than 5,000 fossil fuel lobbyists were given access to UN climate summits over the past 4 years, a period marked by a rise in catastrophic extreme weather, inadequate climate action, and record oil and gas expansion. Explain exactly what you found.
So this is research that's conducted by the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition, which is a coalition of hundreds of organisations around the world. And what they found is in the last 4 years, more than 5,350 lobbyists representing fossil fuel companies, trade associations and other organisations representing oil, gas and coal have been given access to the climate talks. This far outnumbers the negotiators and the delegations that are present from most countries, right? And it also excludes all of the lobbyists sent to represent other big polluting industries that benefit from fossil fuel extraction, like big agriculture, like mining, big tech, finance, and also excludes the fossil fuel lobbyists or the executives who are on official delegations. So why does this matter? So these companies have long said, and the UNFCCC has agreed that they need a seat at the table, that they're part of the solution, they're there with technology, they want to make a transition. This research shows that is just absolutely not true. Just 90 of the oil, gas and coal companies that sent lobbyists in the last 4 years are responsible for almost 60% of the oil and gas that was drilled last year, and responsible for almost two-thirds of the short-term oil and gas expansion projects that are about to start extracting and exploration. And on that second figure, that, you know, if they all go ahead, they will drill the equivalent of enough oil to coat the landmass of 7 European countries entirely, including France, Germany and Denmark. So, you know, these companies are sending lobbyists in order to block climate action. This is climate obstruction at work. They're there to delay meaningful climate action, which every country in the world is obliged to do under international law. And they're there to promote false solutions like carbon markets, carbon capture and storage, these market-based solutions, which are not going to save the planet. You know, we know from all the science out there, and we now know that under international law, every single country in the world, whether they're a member of the Paris Agreement or not, are obliged under law to stop fossil fuel extraction, to stop licenses, to stop subsidies.